From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Bernard-Henri Lévy is one of Europe's most widely published and influential thinkers. The celebrated French philosopher is part journalist, part novelist, part activist, and all passionate provocateur. Lévy divides his time among missions to Afghanistan, consultations with world leaders, reporting sojourns to Sri Lanka, Sudan, Angola, omnipresent TV and newspaper gigs, and, of course, some bon moments with his movie star wife at their palace in Marrakesh. It is hard to overestimate Lévy's influence in his home country, which every year offers him its top honors for citizens who distinguish themselves through valor. His movements are tracked with the kind of rapt attention Americans reserve for celebrity sports heroes and rock stars. Lévy's book, War, Evil, and the End of History, has just been released in translation in the United States. It chronicles his travels and meditations for Le Monde, gathered in what he calls the world's forgotten war zones, Sudan, Sri Lanka, Angola, Colombia, Burundi, along with philosophical riffs on the meaning of history, the power of religion, and the heart of terrorism. He's with us tonight to talk about that heart and more. Tonight on Point, Bernard-Henri Lévy on freedom, terror, and our moment in history. What's your big, bold question for this big, bold thinker on life, history, and our shared moment? Your question for the hottest public philosopher in France. You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Bernard-Henri Lévy, journalist, philosopher, activist, and author of War, Evil, and the End of History. Good evening and welcome, Mr. Lévy.
Good evening.
Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, too. I'm glad to be here.
So let me live a moment with you and get your philosopher's response. Just in the seconds before we came on air in this hour, my producers burst through the door and handed me a new wire story from the Associated Press. And let me just read the lead to you here and get your reaction. It says, U.S. officials have obtained new intelligence deemed highly credible, indicating al-Qaeda or other terrorists are in the United States and preparing to launch a major attack this summer, the Associated Press has learned. And it goes on to say there's a steady drumbeat indicating they are going to attack and hit us hard this in the summer. But Henri Lévy, this is the sharpest, biggest warning we've heard in months, that we've had warnings over the last year, but it seems so indicative of the time we live in. The piece of paper flutters through my door, and this is the news. How do you respond to this kind of warning, to this kind of world that we live in now?
I think that it is our fate since a few years. It is our fate. We live in a new age, which is the age of terrorism. The suicide bombers, for instance, are a new sort of population which will multiplicate under our eyes. This point, for instance, I understood it and I discovered it a few years ago when I wrote this new book, which is being published now, when I was in Sri Lanka. Sri Lanka is a very remote place, mm-hmm. of which few Americans, I suppose, have heard that the war is going on there, but they invented the kamikazes. They invented the suicide bombers. And I had the chance there during my reporting to find some of them and to debrief one of them.
With the Tamil
explaining
Tigers?
Explaining to me, Tamil Tiger, mm-hmm. yes. I debriefed a young woman who has been shaped, trained in order to become a suicide bomber. So, as for myself, I saw the threat coming on since a few years. I'm not so much surprised. I think that it is one of the characteristics of our present time, and I say why in this book.
You set out in the year 2000, before the attacks of 9/11, to report this series for Le Monde from a number of countries, Burundi, Angola, Sudan, Sri Lanka, Colombia in South America, which are in the grips of what you call forgotten wars. And now in a new preface in this English translation, you write about this, the idea of these as kamikazes, who effectively say through their terrorism, you write,
You ignored us while we were alive. Now here we are, dead. You didn't want to know about our deaths as long as they happened in our own countries. Now we throw them at your feet into the same fire that is consuming you. We, who were invisible when alive, will become clear to you as suicides. Is this, are you describing terrorism then as a cry for recognition, a cry for help, not an attack?
There is two sorts of terrorism, of course. The Al-Qaeda terrorism does not work like this. It is not the fruit of despair. It is not the son of distress. It is not a cry for help. It is just nihilism and just hatred. This is Al-Qaeda. This is Osama bin Laden, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and so on. They are not poor people, by the way. They are rich people, wealthy, coming from the best families in Egypt and sometimes in London, like the murderer of Daniel Pearl. This is one category of terrorists. Towards these, we have nothing to do except to try to resist them and to suppress them. But now you have a second category, who will be in the next years the mercenaries, the big army, the suppletive of this army, Al-Qaeda and so on, which are, yes, I think so, some people absolutely despaired and which only way of existing, which only part and role on the stage of history could be to belong and to join the big army of the crime. And when I say that we should, we, American and French, Westerners in general, when I say that we should care of these forgotten wars, when I say that we have the duty to take care of these silent and without face dead men and women, I say two things. Number one, it is a moral duty, because humanity is a whole. There is not two humanities or two standard humanity. But number two, it is our interest. It is our. It will be for our profit. If we don't care about these people, they will care about us, and they could provoke and introduce chaos in the very middle of our societies.
Chaos.
You speak. Sorry for the accent.
No, not at all. You speak there of an American and French we, that is, American and French together as the West. But is there such a we anymore? Are America and France still we, partners?
You know, my dear host, when you come back like I do from these earth of hell, when you come back from these black holes, when you come back from these territories of absolute distress, where I come back myself, Burundi, Angola, Sri Lanka, and so on, the quarrels between American and French look like very petty quarrels, like quarrels of children in a sandbox, Mr. Bush and Mr. Chirac quarreling about egotism, prevalence of this or that. They are like children in a sandbox. If you compare that to the very stakes of today, if you put this in front of this distressed humanity, which is starving, crying, calling for our help, they should have the decency to stop their quarrels. Of course, there is a we. When you look the world from Bujumbura, from Colombo in Sri Lanka, from Angola, of course you see a we.
You've written that anti-Americanism, and we've seen a lot of that from France in the last year, and plenty of anti-French sentiment in return. You may describe it as quarrels in a sandbox, but you've also written very interestingly about it. You've said that anti-Americanism, when it comes out, you see a kind of warning light go on that signals the worst, that signals something in fascism and anti-Semitism, nationalism, racism in the French that doesn't like the United States because it's not organic, because it's founded on a constitution, not nature, that it's seen as a chemical nation, inorganic, the triumph of law, of abstraction, of institution over nature. And you have rejected that French view, as I see.
This is true, too. I say on the same time that the quarrel of Chirac and Bush is children in the sandbox, and also that there is a strong anti-Americanism in France and a strong anti-Frenchism in America. And what I say is that these two strong tendencies express the worst of our two countries, the worst of America, the hate of culture, the despise of intelligence, of ethics, and so on. The worst of America expresses in itself in this stupid hatred of France. And vice versa, the worst of France, our fascism, our extreme right, our despise of a nation built by a sort of contract and not rooted in a race and in a blood, in a common race and common blood, expresses itself in our despise and hatred of America. Anti-Americanism in France is a magnet of the worst. Anti-Americanism, anti-Semitism, chauvinism, racism, all this gathers around this magnet, which is anti-Americanism. Same in your country, here in New York and in deep America. The magnet of the worst tendencies of your country is the hatred of France and of Europe. This is a common task. Us in France to resist anti-Americanism. You in America resist to this cliché which is built especially by the neoconservateur of France compared to Venus and so on and so on, which is bullshit. It is our common duty. We have to build this bridge between our two countries, and I am a militant of that too.
So you see a fundamental trap when these two countries look at each other, that they can turn to their worst instincts. But let me ask you, Bernard-Henri Lévy, after almost 3 years of the American War on Terror, after more than a year of war in Iraq now, do you see a legitimate French policy critique of the way the United States has responded to 9/11, the way it has moved in Iraq, or do you support those moves?
It's more complicated like that.
We suspected that.
I mean by that. Oh, I am not a dogmatic, and the subject is too serious to support dogmatism. President Bush, when he went into Afghanistan, he was right. This was the right way to fight terror, and I supported myself this intervention in Afghanistan. But on the second side, when he decided to make this war in Iraq, it was a wrong war at the wrong time for wrong reasons and in the wrong place. This is what the French policy said, and France was right. I'm sorry to have to say this, but Villepin was right. Not, I don't say that because he is French. If you knew how often I criticize the policy of my own government, they don't like me so much because they know I am uncontrollable. I am considered in my country as an unguided missile. Unguided missile. They don't trust in my viability. But on this point, they were right. This war in Iraq was an absurdity, and it is turning out to be a nightmare. When an absurdity turns out to be a nightmare, it means that it was a fault.
We are talking this evening with French philosopher, journalist, celebrity, provocateur, Bernard-Henri Lévy, one of the most widely published and influential thinkers in Europe, talking about freedom, about terror, about our moment in history. The English translation of his latest book to hit our shores is War, Evil, and the End of History, written for originally from material he wrote for Le Monde, traveling through what he calls forgotten wars around the world. You can join this conversation tonight. What's your question for the hottest public philosopher in France? What's your big, bold question on life, history, and our shared moment for a big, bold thinker, doer, and Talker. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Monsieur Levy, please stand by. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with French philosopher, journalist, celebrity, provocateur Bernard-Henri Lévy. His book, War, Evil, and the End of History, is just out in English translation. It chronicles his travels through many of the forgotten wars of the world in the Sudan, in Colombia, in Burundi, in Sri Lanka. You can join our conversation tonight with one of the most widely published and influential thinkers in Europe, certainly in France. Are you ready, after all that's happened, to listen to a provocative voice from France, from a continent estranged in many parts from America? What's your message to our French savant tonight? What should Bernard-Henri Lévy understand about America and Americans? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Bernard-Henri Lévy, you, in the 1980s, were a defender of Ronald Reagan.
No, never. My dear Tom, I heard that you said that in the first presentation.
Excuse me if I got it wrong. I thought that...
You got it wrong. I never defended Ronald Reagan. Never.
I thought, and set me straight if I've got it, got it wrong, that you, when Reagan supported what he would call a freedom fighters in Central America, the Contras, for example... that you were at his side, that you were behind him on that.
Never. I was never on the side of Ronald Reagan, neither in this cause nor on the another one.
Well,
never.
I'm glad we got that straight, and forgive me for getting it backwards.
No, it's okay.
Well, I'll just kick off anyway to the question I wanted to put behind that. We've heard your critique of the Iraq War, but what about George Bush more broadly? If you can look at Bush more broadly, how do you see him as a leader of a superpower, as a leader for our moment, our times? What's the Bernard-Henri Lévy critique of the American president?
I don't want to be too provocative against the country, the president of a country which hosts me so gently. But frankly, I don't understand his policy. I don't understand his attitude. I looked at him, for instance, yesterday at the TV when he made this speech about Iraq. Mm-hmm. Something very strange which struck me. He could not express, he could not utter the very word of Abu Ghraib. Three times he had to say it, and three times he said it in a different way.
There was a very interesting stumble there, wasn't there? I mean, on the one hand, maybe he's trying to give it a more accurate pronunciation, which is not an easy for American tongue, perhaps. But it also,
okay,
the first time, didn't it feel a little bit like a guilty stumble or an uncomfortable stumble?
Something like that. Uncomfortable stumble, absolutely. But the most comfortable thing, the honor of George Bush, would have been to plead guilty. George Bush is the chief of the team. Donald Rumsfeld is the number two. They have to express excuses, to express guiltiness. What happens in Abu Ghraib? We know that, us French. We did the same in Algeria 40 years or 50 years ago. A big president, a big chief of state, his grandeur, his height, is to ask pardon for that, is to ask for the pardon of the families, of the people, and of the world. America is a great democracy. It cannot afford to present of itself this terrible image.
He says he wants
and
to tear
way
down.
In which he could not even express it. Yeah. Was a sort of terrible lapsus.
He says he wants to tear down the very prison, Abu Ghraib. Isn't that enough to tear it to the ground as a kind of
He should have done it immediately. When you wage a war in order to throw down a despot like Saddam Hussein, the first thing you do is immediately, first, to protect the places of culture, the museum, and so on, which he did not do. And second, to destroy the symbols of the ancient regime. It was like La prise de la Bastille, the take of the Bastille in the French Revolution, the first thing you have to do is to destroy the symbol and not to use it at your profit.
And instead the American soldiers moved in.
That is a scandal. That is a terrible thing. How can this great democracy, for me, the GIs of America, they are still, in a way, the boys of the D-Day who liberated my country. And my mother told me how heroic they were at this time in 1944. How can the inheritors of these GIs come inside the prison, the jail of Abu Ghraib, as if nothing, after the killers of Saddam Hussein, just putting their own foot in the footsteps of the killers of Saddam Hussein. The mistake was there. He should have destroyed it immediately.
After the
invasion.
And not
as an afterthought.
Let me take you to a bigger question around that speech last night.
This is big.
I don't want to diminish it in any way, but I think George Bush at least tried to put out even some larger framework. He said, and I know you're drawing a distinction between types of terrorism tonight, and maybe you can put it in that context, but he said last night again that the war on terror, I'm broadly characterizing here, but he said it is a war between those who love freedom and those who do not. Is that, in your view, Bernard-Henri Lévy, an accurate characterization?
This is true. Of course it is true. The terrorist hate in America, not what America does wrong, but what America does well. It is the virtues of America, which is the taste of freedom, the liberty of the manners, the freedom of the speech, and so on, which the terrorists hate. In a way, when Bush says that, he's right. But he should go to the end. If this is a fight, it is not only a fight between the West and the rest. It is not only the fight between a good and saint and holy America and the bad and dirty rest of the world. This fight goes also inside the rest of the world. This fight between those who love and those who hate liberty is also a fight inside Algeria, inside Pakistan, inside Iraq, inside all parts of the world, and inside Islam. For me, this is one of the themes of my new book. For me, the real clash of civilization of today is the clash between an Islam of liberty and an Islam of oppression. And this fight is the real fight of our days. Our task, the task of America, of France, of all of us, is to reinforce, to support the moderate Muslim in their fight against the radical Muslims.
So how's that project going? Is America's policy on terror in Afghanistan, in Iraq so far, on balance, helping the moderate Muslims or the Islam of liberty, or is it fanning the flames of the Islam of oppression?
Unfortunately, and I don't want to make polemics, the situation is too serious for that. And I think also today, and really, I think about the young boys, the young American boys who are there in difficult conditions, who must be full of shame because of the image which one battalion gave of their army. So I don't want to be polemic, but what happens in Iraq does not go in the right direction. It is not precisely what I would call a defense of moderate Islam against the radicals. And it is unfortunately an habit for this administration. Remember, before entering in Afghanistan, during years and years, America and France defended the Talibans. My friend, Commander Massoud, the leader of the anti-Taliban resistance.
Killed in the north just a couple of days before 9/11.
2 days before 9/11, he was killed by Al-Qaeda. How lonely he was. Again, there is one of the most important chapters of the book about him and about his loneliness. America was not at his side. France was not at his side. We were, both of us, we were on the side of the most powerful, of the side of those who were supposed to be able to make secure the channeling of the oil through Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. And we did a bad action. In Algeria.
Where your family hearkens from.
Yes, of course. And also where I was in the middle of the 90s to make a reporting again, which mm-hmm. is not on this book, but mm-hmm. which I did in these years. It was like the first step of this war between the two Islam, the moderate and the radical. We took the party of the radicals. There was at this time a party called the FIS, F-I-S, mm-hmm. which was the army and the front of the radical Muslims who killed the women, who cut into pieces the babies of the moderate Islamic families. We supported them, we, French and American. So we don't take the good path.
Why are the United States and France then finding themselves on the wrong side of this battle within Islam that you describe?
This is another theme of this new book. I observe that since the beginning of the 20th century, it was very hard, very difficult, and very rare that we really defend our values. At the moment of the Armenian genocide, who was on the side of the genocided people? Nobody. At the time of the Spanish War, when democracy was hit by fascism, we let, by our non-intervention, Spanish people, Democrats, being killed and so on. At the time of the expansion of the Soviet Union, the partition of the Europe into two, we let it to be done. Where the workers of East Germany revolted against the fascists of Moscow, and even the workers, the simple workers of Hungary and of Prague a few years after, we let them fall completely. There is a strange and constant difficulty of the Western world to defend his own values. I remember recently in Bosnia, a story which I know well, and there is again in this book some chapters about that. I was, and we were a few of us, like Susan Sontag in America and me in France, so despaired. It was in such a despair. It was our values which were at stake in Bosnia.
You saw secular Islam on trial there.
Secular Islam, yes. This moderate Islam, which we are desperately seeking, it was there since centuries in Bosnia. And our governments, French and America, during 4 years, we did let them die. At the end, at the last whisper of these people, we made the bombing and we tried to save what could be saved.
We know that history, but I'm not sure I understand, Bernard-Henri Lévy, what you're saying here about what the United States and maybe even France ought to be doing now. You said that your initial response was that these countries are not supporting moderate Islam, that they're, in fact, somehow, however unintentionally, encouraging oppressive Islam. So how could the dials be turned to encourage the Islam that you have such affection for?
It is a fact. And again, in Bosnia, it was so clear, it was crystal clear, we let them die, the moderate Muslim, and in all those circumstances. Today, in Darfur, for instance, in Sudan. Which is one of the main subjects of this book, I went there. I am one of the few reporters, I think, to have gone there on the ground where the bloodbath take place in the south of Islam. Again, you have radical Muslims against moderate Muslims. We let the bloodbath being done. We don't care. We think that these people have no strategic importance, that they can die without putting any trouble to the order of the world.
But isn't it Islam versus Christians in some dimension there?
There is the two. In Darfur, it is Muslims versus Muslims. In the Nuba Mountains, it is Christian versus Islamism. In other areas, it is animists against Muslims, radical Muslims. But whatever is the situation, the Sudan is a black hole of modern history, and we do as if what happened there did not concern us. We close the door and we drop the key.
But,
we close the door and we send the key to the people on the other side of the door.
But George Bush might say in response to this line of thinking, Bernard Lévy, look, this is, we've taken your advice. Iraq was one vast tyranny, and we went there to liberate the Iraqis. So why aren't you happy?
Because I think that there was other ways to do that. I am not in favor of declaring the war to everybody. I think that the duty of our governments, for instance, in Sudan, is pressure, diplomatic pressure, economic pressure, and at the end, when all has been tempted and with caution, military. But it is the end. In Iraq, we did not do in this way. There were other ways to throw down Saddam Hussein. There were other people than this Shalabi to support. In the State Department, I read recently an article saying that so few specialists even spoke the Arabic and knew the real cultural situation of the country. You cannot wage a war like this, as a sort of video game, without knowing, without taking caution, and without making a hierarchy of the priorities.
That sounds like common sense. On the other hand, you have said that you're against the cult of common sense. Common sense is rarely right.
Of course, but I don't tell you that it is common sense. Now, common sense is to consider that we are rich and beautiful and prosperous, and that we cannot do anything for these tribes fighting once against each other. This is common sense. This is that a lot of people in the middle of France and in the middle west of America think. They think about Rwanda, for instance, that it is a quarrel of tribes and that nobody can distinguish the black and the gray cats in this tunnel. This is common sense.
So let them fight.
I am against that. Let them fight. Let them kill each other. This is what common sense think. What I think myself is that humanity is one, that there is no two levels or two standards of humanity, and that the fight for the unity of the human gender is of the humanity is a fight of nowadays, and that if we do not wage it, this fight, we shall pay a high price for it.
Bernard-Henri Lévy, there are a lot of callers who want to join us. We'll turn to them just after a break. We're talking tonight with French philosopher, journalist, celebrity, provocateur Bernard-Henri Lévy. The new English translation of his book is War, Evil, and the End of History. You can join us tonight. What's your question for the hottest public philosopher in France? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with French philosopher, journalist, celebrity, provocateur Bernard-Henri Lévy. His new English translation is of a book from just a couple of years ago, updated, is War, Evil, and the End of History, about his journeys, physical and philosophical, through what he calls the forgotten wars of the world, in Burundi, in Angola, Sudan, Colombia, Sri Lanka. You can join our conversation tonight. What's your question for our French philosopher tonight, Bernard-Henri Lévy? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Alden is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Alden. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Are you there?
Yes. Yes, we're here.
Yeah, look, what I'm really afraid of is that the Bush and the sort of zeal that he's fomented in this country has sort of set us up in that, you know, even if he's replaced by Kerry, I worry that it's going to take a generation for the rest of the world to forgive and forget what he's precipitated in the Muslim world. I mean, he tries to force democracy. It took him over the last 3 or 4 months. The definition of the term has devolved, and now that it's sort of like a least worst case scenario. I have an 8-month-old son. And where is he going to be? I mean, the conservatives in this country have successfully denigrated the word liberal and made it dirty. I mean, is democracy going to be viewed the way we view communism in this country and the rest of the world over the next, 10 to 50 years?
And Alden, are you saying that because of Abu Ghraib or a larger palette of reasons?
Well, I think I feel that way because I see them using these. I mean, Bush says democracy. He wants to bring democracy to the Middle East, but I don't think he's ever really had a plan for it. And I think that the way everything's went down in Iraq sort of leaves a bad taste in everyone's mouth. And he's attached the word democracy to it, specifically democracy. Yeah. I mean, we're talking to a French philosopher. Yeah. He can speak about democracy. Yeah. You look at Fox News and they sneer at the French as a dirty word.
And you're worried that this will leave a scar, a bruise on the United States, even unto your children's generation.
Shifted the paradigm in a way that everything that we've looked at in the last 100 years has been turned upside down.
Alden, let us pick it up. Bernard-Henri Lévy. You hear the fear.
Yes, I heard. It is true that you cannot defend democracy, pretend to defend democracy, and show this image of yourself. If you want to introduce democracy, you have to offer the example. And what appears in Abu Ghraib, and what Donald Rumsfeld says, that it is not torture but abuses, all this is very shocking. You cannot pretend to be a Democrat and say that naked men chained like dogs is not a torture but an abuse. Mr. Rumsfeld, only for this sentence, should resign. And what I would say to the man who just spoke is that if Mr. Rumsfeld resigned, if Mr. Bush expressed true regrets, if Abu Ghraib was really and soon destroyed, the scar would not be so deep as he fears. Mm. It would not be so deep. You can do evil and you can be forgiven for the evil you do. We intellectuals, sometimes we make mistakes and we are ordered, and it is right, to excuse ourselves, to ask for forgiveness. Same for the men of state, same for the chiefs of government. I would like to hear Mr. Rumsfeld and Mr. Bush asking pardon, of course.
And if they do not,
the scar would not be so deep.
And if they will not, if they do not?
If they do not, if they persist, if they insist, if they continue to say that an abuse is not a torture, and so on, they dishonor themselves, of course. And they create a sort of very deep bitterness in this part of the world and in the Arab world in particular. And this is so unfair because America is a great democracy, because the American army is not a fascist army, will never be a fascist army. Too great a memory, too good guys. It is so unfair, but it will be perceived this way. America today is the hostage of a group of men who, either by excess of ideology or either maybe by excess of cynism, I don't know sufficiently well, they are putting shame on this country. And for me, who love this country, it is a pity.
What about then, our dear guest and French Democrat, as in democracy, What about the project of bringing democracy to the Middle East? Do you think that's the correct agenda? There's now a debate in the United States. People are saying that's preposterous. The United States is overreaching. It has to happen organically. You can't import it. You can't impose it. Is it reasonable for the United States to attempt to bring democracy forcefully to the Middle East?
Bring, yes. Forcefully, not. Bring, of course. Democracy. Every people in the world has right to democracy. This is another theme, another thesis of my book. Those who say we must not import democracy in Middle East, they are racist. Everybody
racist.
Is able, is ready for democracy. Every people has inside himself enough elements to breed and to make grow democracy. But, of course, you cannot do it by force. You cannot do it on a glance. Let's be careful. We had the communist and Marxist messianism, which did so evil. Today we have a democratic messianism, the idea of a sort of supreme good which should appear like a big light to everybody. And if it does not, we have to beat. It is a symmetrical mistake. No messianism. History is difficult. The path, the road is difficult. And this is what the neoconservatives in America and in France sometimes seem not to understand. Why do I go to the ground myself? Why do I go physically? You said it is a philosophical and physical journey to Angola and
You've
so on.
You've been described as a field philosopher.
Yes, field philosopher. Because you have also, if you want to be operative, you have also to go to the field, to have the smell of the field and the ground. You cannot be only in your cabinet in Washington and think that the world will obey to your rules and concepts. You have also to go there in the grassroots of these countries. This is what these ideologues did not do enough.
The risk being lost in ideology if one doesn't. Damon's calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Hi, Damon. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks.
Yeah, sure.
Earlier in your show, your guest was discussing, you know, anti-Americanism in France and anti-French sentiment in America.
Yes.
And it brought to my mind, you know, the concept that, you know, for our part, our anti-French sentiment seemed to be limited to changing the name of French fries to Freedom Fries and dumping French wine into the local streams and rivers, which is silly. I mean, it seems relatively silly. And I wonder if maybe it's not, an expression of maybe the fundamental problem here, which is that instead of dealing with the world as you know, an equal brother, we discipline it like an angry parent.
But was it really just as silly as French fries? It may have been right, may have been wrong, but, you know, there was a critique out there, Damon. Robert Kagan wrote about this, that Europe, while there was important work to be done in the world for freedom, for liberty, Europe was taking a holiday from history. America was shouldering the world's burdens. That, you know, it was paradise in Europe, but power projection in the United States. Was there no kernel of legitimacy to the American complaint in your mind, Damon?
I'm not saying that there wasn't a legitimacy to it. I'm just saying that it wasn't expressed with a sense of a mature critique on something. It was as though we were dismissing the entire nation, ha ha ha, you know, like a misbehaving child.
Just throwing the wine in France's face. Damon, thanks for your call. What about it, Bernard-Henri Lévy? What about Robert Kagan's critique that Europe has tried, is off dreaming in a holiday from history while America is confronting the world as it is?
It is very strange to say that. As you know, the most up-to-date thinker of this story of end of history, holiday of history and so on is not a French, it is an American, Mr. Fukuyama.
Yes.
As far as I know, he is American. This idea of holidays of history is an idea which came from Germany at the beginning of the 19th century and which came back in America at the end of 20th century. So you cannot say that Europe is the place, is the ground, is the stage of this holiday of history, and America, the good guy who continued to put the hands of, in the mud of history. It is a cliché. Also, the sexualization of politics, the feminization of France, which is sometimes at the border of Mr. Kagan's text, is also a bad way to speak on politics. Is also a very frivolous, yes, frivolous way of thinking about, of expressing our differences and our alliance. I think that these men, they are like drunk with their own words and own ideology. I understand that. I am myself an intellectual. Sometimes I feel this way of being drunk with words. Then I go to the field. I go to the ground. I go to real concrete faces. And then I see the world in a different way. They should do that sometimes too.
Johan is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Johan. You're on the air.
Hello. I have two short questions for Bernard Lévy.
Yes.
The first one is about something you said a little earlier. You said that human life is worth another human life. And I was wondering if he felt that he did as much for Rwanda as he did for Bosnia, and if not, why, at the time in 94.
Ooh, that's a tough challenge. Okay.
And the second question is part of the anti-French feelings, at least the rhetoric of it in last fall in the States, had to do with French anti-Semitism.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that in the 80s, Bernard-Henri Lévy was very much involved in fighting racism together with anti-Semitism in France, you know, with SOS Racisme. But since then, he has a little bit given up on the banlieue in France, on the borough. And there is a tendency in his thinking of reducing, you know, those suburbs, those poor suburbs recently, I feel, to some extremist boroughs in France. Whereas, you know, there are many other things to explore, to investigate, and that seems to me that those are a little bit of forgotten territories.
Let us pick up those two. It's interesting. Johan, thanks for your call, Bernard-Henri Lévy. First, a challenge from Johan. He says, yes, you were devoted to Bosnia in the 90s. What about Rwanda? And there's a kind of suggestion there that that race could play a part. And he also asks about how passionately are you picking up anti-Semitism as an issue in your country these days?
On Rwanda, he's right. I did not do enough. We never do enough. Each of us does not do enough. This is true. When I was involved in Bosnia, when I spent half of my life under the bombs in Sarajevo, making this movie, which I did at this time to alert public opinion of the world about the bloodbath in Sarajevo, I was not in Rwanda. This is sure. How to do else? We cannot be everywhere. We cannot have four hands and a dozen of eyes. This is absolutely true. We never do enough. And this is a feeling I have even in this book, in this recent book where I cover these five walls. I did it with my heart, with my body, and sometimes maybe with a few risks to my life. But nevertheless, I finished that with a bitterness, feeling that I did not do enough. I might be the first reporter since a long time to have went to Nuba Mountains, for instance, and I tell this narrative, I tell this trip in detail in the book, no road, no airstrip, no way to go, and so on. I went there, nevertheless, not enough.
Bernard-Henri Lévy,
about racism and anti-Semitism.
We've got 10 seconds.
Give up. Be sure, I don't give up. The only thing is that my idea is that it is not exactly the same, but it would be another theme of conversation, I suppose.
I suppose we'll have to have you back for that. We're grateful for your time tonight and for the English translation. Bernard-Henri Lévy, thank you for joining us tonight.
Sorry for the English and the accent.
Oh, it's wonderful to have you, and wonderful to have the accent as well. Thanks a lot for being
with
us.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks, my dear.
Bernard-Henri Lévy's book is War, Evil, and the End of History. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.